Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is The Real-World Impact of AI, Machine Learning, and Automation in Healthcare. The presenters are Andy Moy, PhD, CEO, Page, I Cancer Diagnostics, Haymarket, Virginia, Robert Ngozian, MBA, PMP, President and CTO, U.S. Health Tech, Inc., Haymarket, Virginia, and Greg Sorensen, MD, CEO and co-founder, Deep Health, Inc., Haymarket, Virginia.
Welcome to session AI is going to take my job, the real-world impact of AI, machine learning, and automation in healthcare. So let's cut to the good news. AI is not going to take your job, but it is changing the landscape in which you're working and living. AI, machine learning, and process automation have been buzzwords within all industries the last couple of years, but there are many different perspectives. Everything from AI being the bubble waiting to burst to the computers are going to take over the world. As with all new technologies and offerings, the reality is going to fall somewhere in between, really between the naysayers and the hype machine. And it will largely depend upon the use case and effort put into leveraging the tools available. So under the right circumstances, we'll implement it in conjunction with resources who understand data and workflow management, the various technologies and tools available. It can transform and enhance your productivity, resulting in a more satisfied outcome for your clients and your patients. My name is Robert Ngozian. I'm president and CTO of US Health Tech. We've been offering healthcare-focused IT solutions for over 20 years now, ranging from network and cloud infrastructure all the way through solutions development, data management, application integration. I welcome you to this great opportunity to learn about how AI is impacting healthcare. Okay, so how can you arm yourself with the right information to begin understanding what AI is, how it can be used, and what are some of the prerequisites? The term AI is thrown around a lot, yet there is a lot lacking of true understanding of what it means in practical terms. For successful real-world application, there needs to be preparation, a rock-solid plan, and the ability to get the data model set up so that AI delivers what's needed to and do it accurately. Our panelists here have functioning AI models that are doing great work for the world, and learning about their journey is key, is going to be immensely valuable to everyone in the room. Understanding the key prerequisites, learning from others, is key to leveraging these new offerings and not feeling at risk of them. So let's meet them, Dr. Sorensen and Andy Moy. Dr. Sorensen, want to introduce yourself?
Oh, sure, it'll be quick. Greg Sorensen, AI guy, radiologist. My first time ever at this meeting. I can see I'm the only one with a tie on, so I'm a little nervous. One more person. Thank you, Scott. Excited to share with you a little bit about the journey of where radiology has been, I would say, gathering scar tissue on the AI journey.
And Andy?
Yeah, good morning. Andy Moy, CEO of Page. We are still a startup, I think. It's been a few years, but we're still a startup. Spun out of Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York City, and still the only company with an FDA-approved algorithm in pathology. It's been almost 3 years now, which is pretty shocking. Obviously, I'm sure we'll talk about that. I'm sure nobody has FDA on their minds this morning, but I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about that.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. All right, so let's jump into it. So AI features solutions and challenges. Obviously, streamlining life cycles, overcoming numerous challenges and barriers, and the lack of tools, knowledge, and the ability to leverage them is some of the key challenges that face AI. So, Dr. Sorensen, you know, what were some of the specific AI features and solutions adoptable to our industry?
Thanks. Thanks, Robert. Thanks for the question, and I'm grateful for the chance to spend a little time with you this morning. I thought I would share with you a couple of things we've learned the hard way. Unlike pathology, in radiology, there are over 500 approved products by the FDA. And despite that, we still haven't quite figured out how to do that sustainably. What's the business model that's going to work? Who's going to pay for this? What will physicians want? What will patients want? How will this really improve care? And I think one of the reasons Andy thought I might be a useful person to have on this panel, and Robert, was because we've started to find a solution in one domain to the those series of questions. And I thought I'd share those with you just to see if that maps into your experience. And I think if I do, I just brought a couple of examples because it's a little easier. Let's see if I can make this go forward.
No? I can hit it if you'd like.
Why don't you go ahead and hit this? Okay, so the example I'm going to share with you is mammography. Many women here have probably experienced mammography. My wife tells me it hurts way too much, which is true. But the goal of a mammogram is, unlike most of what we do in medicine, it's a screening exam. So the person is healthy when they walk in the door. The point is we want to figure out, do they have cancer or not? And this woman does have cancer. And when her cancer was initially, when this mammogram was originally reviewed, the physician, like me, didn't find it. But AI did find it. So if you go to the next slide, you'll see it put a little box around a suspicious area. And this is a little bit like pathology, where you're trying to find a needle in the haystack. And it turns out modern AI is really good at that. Next slide. This is blown up. When it's blown up, we radiologists can say, okay, now I can kind of see what the AI is looking at. Next slide. And this turned out to be invasive ductal carcinoma. Here's another example. Mammograms are hard to read. They're one of the hardest things we do as physicians. And a part of it is it's very tedious. Only about one out of every 200 women have breast cancer in the screening population. So that means if you took the mammograms and you gave them to the janitor and said, read these, and he said, oh, they're all negative, he would be 99.5% right. That's the reality of screening. It's this hard thing to do. And that's actually quite similar to what a lab work is, or a pathologist. You get this big slide, and you're searching everywhere. Where is the thing that I really care about? And that's a hard thing for us physicians. And that's actually, turns out that's something AI is quite good at. So in this mammogram, next slide, the AI found this little spot that, again, the radiologist initially missed. We then sent it, the way we've set up a workflow is when AI finds something that the doctor didn't see, it goes to another expert. And next slide, and she looked at these and said, you know what, I think this is suspicious, decided to bring the woman back. She was biopsied, and this was another cancer. I've got hundreds of these where we have now deployed this AI and are giving it to the doctors, and it's helping them. And it's interesting. It helps different doctors different amounts. Now, one of the things that's different about mammography than most other fields of medicine is we do it a lot, and it's repeated. There's about 40 million a year, and many women come back year after year. And what that means is we can measure how good the doctors are. And that is not a happy thing in many cases. Why? Well, because half the doctors are below average. Newsflash. Right? And what that also means, this graph on the right, there's huge variability in performance. Many doctors don't perform well. And for more than a decade, this is a 1994 publication, we know there's giant variability. So it's another place where AI could really help. And I've heard from my friends in pathology, Andy and otherwise, that this is also true in pathology. Right? So it seems like a prime area for AI. And I can tell you, this is why we radiologists 7 years ago, we're very nervous that AI was going to take our job. It's a hard task. We're not particularly good at it all the time. There's a lot of variability. Quality isn't perfect. AI is better at it. And in fact, AI is better at it. Here's an example. We just published this. The nine squares on the left are nine generalist radiologists reading mammograms. The nine dots on the right are nine specialists reading mammograms, and without AI. And you can see there's a difference in their performance with the center in the error bars. Specialists are better than generalists. Again, newsflash, we all knew that. If you do something full-time, you're better at it. Well, when they get AI, next slide, we see what happens. One more slide, I think. Everybody gets better. All the doctors, the specialist gets better, the generalist gets better. And in fact, what's interesting is the generalists get about as good as the specialists. So this is real world. We've now deployed this. The question that we've had and that we're struggling with is, how do we pay for that? Who pays for that? How can I keep building this? How do I build a sustainable enterprise? Because it took years and millions of dollars to build this, as Andy can tell you, tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars in some cases. How can we keep doing this? It's clearly benefiting patients. And we've gone to payers and said, it benefits patients with this workflow. The AI, the doc looks at it, then the AI looks at it, then another doc looks at it. And the payers have told me, probably what they've told you, no thank you. This won't save us money in the first year. This will cost us money. That's in right. The first year. Because it's extra work. The docs need to look at it, so we don't want to do it. So what we've done, very unusually, we're fortunate in a way that that Andy is not yet. We were acquired by a big provider, my team, about 4 years ago. And that big provider has decided to embed the AI in an offering to patients and ask them to pay directly if they're interested. And about 40% of women do pay $40. And then they get the AI. And we found more than 400 cancers as a result. And that we're now taking to payers. And we have two insurance companies that have said, oh, well, if everybody's paying for it, maybe we'll pay you the $40. Blue Cross Horizon of New Jersey has decided to cover it for some of their beneficiaries. Is that the path to sustainability? I think this is the question that we wanted to kind of talk through. Andy, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. This is great, and so glad to have Dr. Sorensen here because, yeah, radiology has been at this for many, many more years. Everyone in the room that attends USCAP or PathVision, we had the same conversations. Oh, my gosh, AI. I think I can show you the exact same graphs, right? From the Page Prostate, our FDA-approved cancer detection for prostate, 8 different peer-reviewed studies at this point. Our FDA approval, the pivotal study, showed that every generalist got better using AI. Every specialist got better. We reduced the number of times they missed cancer altogether by 70% when they had the AI. As a tool, having the AI in the pathologist's hands and when positioned that way, it's a tool to help you, always helps, right? It has shown in even if it's our AI or Greg's or even one of competitors, it doesn't matter. Generally, having that thing helps. I think overall, the challenge, I think, for most pathologists and hospitals and labs right now, I think there's two challenges. One, are they going to take my job? It's certainly still out there. I think there's some cognitive dissonance going on, however, because I haven't run into a lab director or chair of pathology who says they can recruit enough pathologists. They all say, oh my God, we're short, we have too much work, we can't find any pathologists, Hey, AI can help that. No, that's not it. No, yeah. That's not it. No, that's not it. So I think at some point you have to decide, would you like to have less pathologists, because you're only going to get less pathologists, and have AI help. So, yeah, I think we'll talk through some of those challenges.
Yeah, we have a couple of these topics we're going to touch on just a second as well. All right, so let's look at a second question here, AI scalability and growth challenges. One thing about AI and standing something up, it's great for a proof of concept, but people are realizing to actually scale it out and make it something that can be commercialized, that's a bigger challenge in many ways. Obviously, resource allocations, shortage of skilled personnel, as Andy just referenced, and lack of expertise in machine learning, obviously, are all barriers that make scalability difficult. So what were some of the challenges in incorporating AI so it's scalable for growth and sustainability for the long haul? Andy or Dr. Sorensen?
Want to start?
Yeah, I can start. I think for most hospitals and health systems, there's sort of some confusion, you know, around AI. There's, number one, there's these sort of teams that think, I need to have this very deep domain expertise about AI. And I would sort of challenge everybody to say, well, what's your domain expertise in like manufacturing an IHC reagent? Like, are you good at that? And the answer is usually, well, no. You know, the IHC reagents show up and we put them in the machine and we get the thing. Well, yeah, right. You know, right? Ultimately, the manufacturers of AI, you know, the groups that of AI scientists who've sort of built their careers on and doing this and doing good work, we bring the tools to your facility, and it's just like any other tool. It's, you can validate it, you can get a sensitivity, a specificity, a negative predictive value, a positive predictive value, right? And you can sign off on that. If it's FDA approved, we'll talk about FDA later, but generally, that's something that you can validate in your lab and you can rely on, right, ultimately. And so I think number one, as a user, it's a tool. It's a tool to be able to bring into the lab, and then depending on the scalability of the tool itself, how good that manufacturer is, how good that vendor is. For us, everything is cloud-based. You can, it's just really the speed of your internet and the digitization that you have in your laboratory to be able to use that tool every day, every time that you're using it. So I think number one, for users of AI tools, you don't have to be an AI expert necessarily. I think it's good to understand how those AIs were trained. It's a different topic though, essentially. You know, transparency in the data sets, ensuring you don't have bias in those data sets, ensuring that specific patient populations aren't treated differently by the AI because they weren't never seen by that AI, for example. You know, those things are important to know, but again, they can be validated, right? You can test those AI in your own facility, in your own lab, and do it the same way you would do any other test that you would bring into your laboratory. And so I think people sort of get scared All AI, how are we going to know if it works? I get the question all the time. How are you going to know it works all the time? The other thing I would also challenge people on is that it's not perfect. You know, by definition, 99% sensitive means 1 out of 100 is false negative, right? We get this all the time. You know, groups that use our AI, they'll come to us. We found one. You know, it took 3 doctors and a consensus board, but we found cancer that your AI missed. And like, was that 1 out of 100? Like, well, maybe that sounds about right. 99% sensitive, right? That's what we market just like any other tool. So I think from bringing it in, scalability, using it reliably in your facility, it can be done, but everybody sort of has to understand those parameters. AI is not perfect. It doesn't find it every time, but it is a tool to help the pathologist or the radiologist do his or her job better than they would otherwise and get better patient outcomes. And I think if that's the goal for your facility, that's why you would bring in AI to your facility.
Yeah, I agree. I'd echo all of that. The physician paranoia is still there and the unwillingness to see the AI as part of the solution. That's starting to change in radiology I would say most of the fear comes from people who haven't used it. Yep. Once you've started to use it, then you're like, oh, well, this isn't taking my job. This is actually, I'm doing more RVUs per hour. I'm a happy doctor. Yep. And I'm doing better at my job. I'm providing better patient care. So I think finding... you know, the old saying, the difference between, you know, the settlers and the pioneers are who gets the arrows in their back, right? So you definitely want to be a settler, but there are us pioneers out there who have arrows in our back, and we can show you sort of what we've learned. Yeah. And I think what we have learned is it is doable. Pathology isn't as digitized as radiology, so there's a whole journey around there. Yeah. And that is a prerequisite because that's how these tools work. But they are super valuable, and I would say scale is part of the secret sauce. Mm. Because it is effort, if you can spread that effort over a bigger base, then the incremental value kind of accrues more favorably. The last thing I would say is I totally agree with Andy about there are a number of groups whose careers are set on trying to have a good reputation. So find a reputable vendor who has been at it for a while and who wants to be in it. And in my provider's case, we felt like we wanted to own it so that we could guarantee that the quality would be there. And I think that is still an option. There's a lot of hundreds of AI companies still out there. The other thing I would say that's super interesting about the time we live in is even in the last 6 months, we were talking about this over coffee, the rate of improvement in AI continues to go up. So how it gets deployed, I think we're all still feeling our way on, but the AI is not getting dumber. It's getting smarter and more capable. And so I think to ignore it at this stage is really a head in the sand bad idea. I think it's not going to take anybody's job, but it will make people more efficient, and it really is capable of adding value to patient care in some critical ways.
Great, thank you. Okay, great. Next topic here, AI economic and equity impact. Obviously, everyone knows that investing in AI can be costly, and the return on that, again, can be elusive. We've heard issues about payers not wanting to reimburse for services, and then possibly, passing that on to the consumer as out-of-pocket, which, again, can present some other ethical issues. So the question is, what are the regulatory and economic impacts to look out for? Gentlemen?
Yeah, let me start with the story. when I met with somebody at a large, I won't unnamed, but very large payer, and asked her about our results, and it turned out she was in charge of new innovations in especially in imaging, and she herself had been a breast imager in my state, and I was like, Lori, don't you want this? And she said, look, Greg, I get it. This is helping find more cancers, but I can tell you how our company works. We have an innovation committee. We look for an ROI in 18 months. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a positive return on our investment for us as an insurer, we're not going to approve your product. And I said, why 18 months? Because, the cancer I detect earlier, but it's for sure, I get it that you're going to spend more on chemo the first 6 months, but over the 5-year period. She said, the problem is patients only stay with us and insurer on average 18 to 24 months. And then their employer switches them to a different insurer. So if I invest in your cool technology, it won't help me. Number one, I was frustrated, like, welcome to American healthcare. That's really dumb. But number two, I said, okay, I get it now. I understand your problem. So we went back and said, let's not just find more cancers. Let's reduce unnecessary recalls. let's stop having 15% of women come back for a follow-up exam. Let's find more cancers but only have 9% of women or 8%. In Europe, it's at 4%. So it's possible to do this. Now, they get to 4% by having two doctors. They have two doctors read everything, and that's more expensive than America wants to pay for because we pay our doctors more than they pay them in Europe. We thought, okay, let's do this other thing, and then we can essentially meet them where they are. So I think we're all learning here that the economics are what lead to sustainability, and you need to have a sustainable model that works for you sustainably. For sure, we don't like charging patients. We wish the insurers would just pay us. But we saw this with 3D mammography. When it came out, no insurers wanted to pay for it. A lot of groups charge patients $50 to $75, and eventually, it took like 8 years, I think, the payers came around, and now all the payers pay. And I think we're on that journey with AI. It's some kinds of AI, we essentially have to shame the payers into paying, and then they will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in radiology, there may be 4 or 5 reimbursed tests generally, right?
Very few.
Very specific.
Yeah, just a few.
Use case applications. Yeah, you know, not yeah, exactly as Greg said, you know, prostate cancer is even harder. Like even if you go to Medicare and you go to the max, the problem with prostate cancer, and the problem is it's not necessarily a very lethal disease, right? Most men die with prostate cancer, I die of prostate cancer. If you just look at the statistics overall. So even in the Medicare population, the over 65 population, they still have that challenge. Like, well, even over a 5 or 10 year period, even if you find that prostate cancer a year earlier, it doesn't really change the economics. It's a challenge right now. We have a 2-year prospective study happening in the UK right now. It's been going on. We should get a readout this summer. And a lot of the, in using Paige Prostate, and what we're excited about the results of that is that it's health economic driven. So it's cost effective. So obviously, UK, very different, one payer, essentially, right? And they're going to look at, okay, if you find these patients earlier using AI, is there downstream benefit to it that you could ultimately get some sort of reimbursement for? You know, of course, hopefully it turns out well for us, you know, this particular thing. The UK comes back and says, look, this is great. You found more prostate cancers, but generally we don't find the economics to be worth it. And I think overall that's going to be, you know, the challenge in all of these new innovations. And as Greg said, the technology is already way outstripping the ability for payers to even consider it. For example, you know, over the past few years, we've built sort of tumor-specific modules, breast cancer, prostate cancer. But now the technology is such that we can detect cancer across 20 different tumor types, right? We can detect cancer in the next few months at 24 different tumor types, all of these tumor types. So now it becomes a triage. You can actually use the AI as a pathologist to triage your entire workload and determine what's suspicious and what's not suspicious. Well, who's going to pay for that? You know, how are they going to pay for it? How is a hospital going to essentially say, okay, I can afford an extra $5, $10, $20 a case when already reimbursements in pathology are getting squeezed, right? We hear this all the time, $8,305, $60 for a global. I mean, how am I going to find $5 or $10 for that for AI? And so I think this really is going to be the overall challenge. I think most of the groups that use AI that are our customers today in pathology do it because they see the efficiency gains, right? Number one, the efficiency gains are real. The ability to not have to go find that pathologist you couldn't find anyway, but still keep up with your workloads is real. That's a real phenomenon. I think they ultimately, every now and then, that pathologist has that, oh shit, I missed that, and the AI caught it moment, and I do like this, right? And no, they don't bring that to anybody. It's the very rare pathologist that says to me, hey, Andy, I missed one, and you guys got it, right? But it does happen, essentially. And so they find that there's a sense of I can sleep at night with AI. And so how do you put a price tag on those kind of things? I mean, ultimately, the problem in American healthcare is that we don't pay for quality, essentially. Right? We don't necessarily pay for better quality outcomes for patients. It's not what we pay for. I should say this too. I think it's going to come to a very difficult head at some point, because I think over the next 5 to 10 years, there's like 3 different major forces all happening at the same time. One, there is a major dearth of pathologists. Pathologists are not coming into the field at the rate that you need them. The patient population is getting older and older, to combine with more screening techniques, more younger people being found with cancer, the prevalence of cancer, the diagnostic rate going way up, you know, I think the NCIS will have double the number of new cancer diagnoses in the next 10 years. So who's going to make those diagnoses if you don't find the pathologists? I think the advent of liquid biopsy is going to continue to drive this forward. The people that think liquid biopsy is going to replace real tissue biopsy are crazy. No. Right? I think you're going to get grail. And patients are paying for that out of pocket for the most part, right? They're paying for it. They go, they get a grail. They get a full body MRI.
Yep.
I mean, that's a fun one, right? If you guys don't know what Ezra is or some of these other companies that offer full body MRI scans amongst the, you know, I don't know. It's getting uptake, right? And so people go get a full body up. Oh my gosh, sure. What's this? I need a biopsy, right? These things are only going to drive the volumes forward. At some point, the payers, Medicare, whoever, is going to have to pay for efficiency. Like, because that's always been a bad word. Oh my God, you can't pay. It's got to be quality. Well, you don't pay for quality or efficiency. What's it going to be? So ultimately, I think, again, if you're a hospital lab or lab administrator or pathologist, it's about starting that journey now. Like, you don't want to be in 5 years trying to figure out how to be digital, how to employ AI tools, because you can't find pathologists, you can't keep up with the workflow, you can't keep up with the workload. None of your pathologists want to live in your town. They all want to work from home, right? You know, like, if you're not working on it right now, you're behind. And I think it always feels like, it's coming, it may never come, but there's going to be this tsunami of these things happening all at the same time that's going to drive it, I think.
Yeah, we like to say in radiology that, at least, and I think this is going to be true for all specialties, AI is not going to replace the physician, but physicians that use AI are going to replace the physicians who don't use AI.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that we really see the pairing together as very powerful. And I think at least we can see a path in radiology where that's going to be that kind of like, well, here's how old I am. When I was an intern, we still had manual differentials. I don't know if any of you remember those, but because the machines were new enough, we didn't trust them to do the white blood smear, right? And so you could request a manual differential. And now that happens, as my understanding, very rarely, very extremely rarely, right? And but there still is a pathologist who oversees what the machine does.
Yep.
And I think that's going to happen in more of our specialties.
Yep.
We will have a machine that looks at the pap smear or looks at the mammogram and says no human needs to review this. It already happens with 25% of pap smears, of course. I think it'll happen with 25 or 60% of mammograms because the AI will be that good. And it will be better for patients. Why? Because doctors hallucinate things on those mammograms and think there are cancers when there are not there. And they call back women and they get biopsied that they don't need to get biopsied. This is where the arc is headed. And so the question, I guess, for all of us is, do you want to have that be a wave that you surf, or is that going to be a tsunami that washes you away?
Yeah.
You know, which is it going to be for you?
Yeah.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. With all the benefits that you guys just referenced, the next topic here I have is AI pitfalls.
Yeah.
So as you went through your journey, and with a lot of the news that you hear about AI kicking out wrong data, hallucinations, things of that of references, having weak data that feeds those models, and then because of that having poor implementation leading to expensive fixes. So how important was the quality of the data and the preparation of that data and this equation for your guys' solutions?
This is how you guys got founded.
Yeah, I can start with that. I mean, in all of AI, large language models, it's all about the data, right? It's the data that you to train on. And I think HHS, the White House, in Europe, you're seeing this more and more, these sort of transparency laws, you know, so that you have clear visibility to what those models were trained on. And I think it's just critical. I mean, I think overall, you know, if you can get a nutritional label on your can of SpaghettiOs and know exactly what went into that thing, you should know exactly what kind of data the models were trained on, and because it's critical. And because if your population of the patients that you serve is different than what that model was trained on, then that model is simply just not going to work, you know, or it's going to have these issues, particularly in medical imaging. You know, those kind of things. For us, you know, we're very fortunate to have access to the Memorial Sloan Kettering data, and if that's not single site data, because about 35% of those slides were made somewhere else, 800 different labs, 50 countries, it all because patients come there for treatment, they bring their slides with them, and so we have access to this. So it becomes a very robust, generalizable, wide data set. And I think that's really the hard thing to replicate. Right, you have to have something that's going to work every time on every type of patient population. I call that clinical grade. And I think one of the challenges too, and for those in health systems and hospitals, somewhere in your health system or hospital is a guy who thinks he's an AI guy, right? And we have data here. And, you want to find the patients that do X, Y? Oh, I can build a model. I got a model, right? And and AI goes from, just good old-fashioned logistical regression. Like, that's not AI, by the way. So, but you can do that, and your guy will say, I got an AI model for you, and it's just logistical regression. Or all the way into really deep learning models. But that person in your hospital or health system may not really understand the quality of the data, what the data is for. And this is how Epic got in trouble with some of their sepsis stuff. This is how a lot of health systems get in trouble building a model. And I think the question for all providers needs to be, if I'm going to make a decision based on what that AI tells me, I better A, know, again, what I said earlier, all the statistics are associated with that on a validation study, sensitivity, specificity, so I know exactly what I'm dealing with here. And B, what the data was that particular model was trained on. Because if I'm going to make a decision about a patient's treatment in some form or fashion, I can't just rely on AI guy's model. And I think this is really going to be the hard thing for hospital and health systems. Either A, their internal models that are getting sort of pushed on them by the AI guy in the health system, or a billion vendors who come down on everybody and say, I've got the latest, greatest AI system as well.
Yeah, I would echo that. I think the data provenance is critical. We can all, if you've played with any of the large language models, you can see that sometimes they hallucinate, yeah. Sometimes they say things that we know aren't true. And so it naturally leads you and it leads the FDA to wonder, is that happening in the image-based models? And the good news here is I think the FDA is actually quite solid scientifically. They've really gotten in, especially in medical imaging, I think they've got over 700 now across all the fields, AI, things they've approved. And they have a rhythm that I respect. It's not easy, and they know how to look for these pitfalls. So if you don't want to do all the work yourself to dig through those questions that Andy laid out, because those are important questions, the FDA forces us as manufacturers to do that. And so they will not grant approval if they aren't confident not just on the data provenance of where you trained, but also the data you test on. They're very good about making sure that you don't test on the stuff you train on, all the pitfalls that early birds and the early innovators might not have necessarily noticed. It's a more mature field now. And so one thing I will tell you is right now there are no models that continuously learn. It's kind of a thought that OpenAI is training on my queries, and OpenAI might be training on your queries, but there are no medically cleared products by the FDA that do that. FDA insists that if you change your model, they want to see a new 510K submission. So there isn't yet, although they've laid out some possibilities for one of the ultrasound cardiac models to do updates in the field. Yeah. But for the most part, like I said, maybe one out of 700, it just doesn't happen. The FDA really wants to see that change. So you can, I would say kind of the simple way to think about those concerns around data is this thing FDA cleared or not? And if it is, then the FDA has scrutinized to at least a degree. Now, does that mean it's gonna work in your population? Right. Well, if you read the label, it will typically describe the population that it was tested in. And for example, a very common thing is, did the images get made with my vendor's camera? Because some of the cameras are different, whether it's Siemens or GE or Philips or Leica or whatever, those cameras do have known differences. And so the FDA will insist that we manufacturers essentially list those things out. So it gets down to that level of granularity, but that's what you need in order to be confident in the results. There are some pitfalls, for sure. And I think the easiest thing to do is go to a trusted partner or vendor or friend that's done it and learn from their scar tissue.
Appreciate it, gentlemen. Thank you. All right, next topic, AI implementation goals. Obviously, improved efficiencies, more face time with patients, expedited revenue cycle. Those are all key points that you hear a lot about implementation goals within healthcare. So what does the future look like for us if AI is adopted successfully?
You want to start?
Yeah, sure. When I started DeepHealth, we had a silly tagline that I still kind of like, which was bringing the best doctor in the world to every patient. I do think that the nice thing about these equations, and at the heart of the software, it's a set of linear algebra equations, they can distill hundreds of doctors, thousands of doctors, millions of doctors' experience down into a set of reproducible software instructions. Mm-hmm. And that's really cool. The number of, just as Andy was saying, we train the equations on things, on examples. You can think of it like a really good memory bank. It remembers things that it's seen. And so the mammography AI has seen many, many physicians' lifetimes experience in looking at these cancers distilled down into that. And that's really cool, I think. It still makes me happy to think we could build a tool that somebody in any country could get access to that level of expertise. And I think that's in our future. I really do. I think that we are eventually gonna say this distillation, it doesn't handle outliers as well as a clever physician. We're still gonna need somebody to integrate new knowledge because we're never gonna not for many years are we gonna have something that integrates everything about past history and biopsy results and all the stuff that makes medicine medicine. But in terms of sort of the key question of, is there something in this medical image? I think the AI is really going to eventually outperform almost all doctors. And that's really good news. I think it means patients are going to get better care. We have, you know, I'm part of a big provider organization that has a lot of inner city locations where I can tell you the well-paid doctors don't want to go there because their cars get broken into. And it's hard to get people to go to those locations. And that means, I can't only help but think that means patient care isn't as good in those locations. They don't get the best doctor in the world. And AI, I think, will equalize that. We are seeing, so I think there's a lot of good that's coming from this scrutiny about what performance looks like and was AI improving that performance. And the answer consistently is yes. And if it's not, then we don't adopt it, right? So it's actually moving things in the better direction. So I do think this will be something that helps doctors be better at their jobs and be more efficient. So those forces are powerful, and I think every physician group, but I think both radiology and pathology have these huge shortages that are forecast to get worse. Yep. And so I think AI is part of the solution for both of our practices, yep, in addition to the quality boost. Yep. I think it's coming. How is still very uncertain. Yep. How will it get paid for? Yep. Will the doctors pay for it because now they get to go home at 7 p.m. instead of 8 p.m.? Maybe. Yeah. If there's enough value created, that's all still very uncertain. How will it get regulated? Still, you know, kind of a thing in process. I think it's why it's wise to have meetings like this. And I'd love to hear your experience and your questions and other things. So I hope we have a little bit of time for that.
No, I agree with everything Greg said. I think maybe just a practical point in adoption of AI today, right? I think you have to get the plumbing right, right? If the pathologist's workflow is in any way, I don't know if people remember, I mean, I'm about old enough, but like I first started, there was like these scanners, like Chroma Vision scanners for like HER2. Like it took 20 minutes to scan a slide, but then you'd put it over the internet. It was like 20 minutes, you'd sit and wait. But like, you know, like those sort of things, because there was a, why? Because you did that because there was a reimbursement, you know, advantage to it. Not anymore. Essentially, you have to have the workflow. So like to give US Health Tech a plug, you know, to ensure that all the LIS information flows into the system, your digital pathology system, the platform like Paige, your AI is native, it all happens at the same time, you're not wasting time pressing buttons, waiting for things to upload, waiting for AI results to come down. That kind of stuff, I think, is the death knell for all pathology, in any sort of practical AI adoption. Right? It's the first time a pathologist or somebody has to sit and like, oh, I have to switch to another viewer. Oh, I have to find, you know, my other passcode for that viewer. Like those kind of things sound ticky-tack. But to a physician, they're just death, right? They're just, from a practical example. So, you know, having that clean flow, you know, obviously is a plug for Paige. We do this from end to end, that full digital transformation, so that all of that stuff is very seamless. And that's number one. Number two, the future of AI generally, I agree. I think there's going to be a world with the technology, and it's already here, where we can predict response to patients on specific drugs. We can predict where that patient has specific genomic drivers. Greg and I were talking this morning about multimodal models where you adopt both radiology and pathology, perhaps also cytology, you bring an EHR. You have a single predictive model for a patient on a specific application that then has really good downstream applications for that patient, meaning that patient shouldn't get a chemo, maybe that patient should get a targeted therapy, and you're gonna get really good outcomes. Those kind of things, like when you think about cancer in general, should get people really excited. Like it gets me excited, it gets me up in the morning like, man, we're making a difference with technology where we're actually predicting, and the honest to God truth is today in America, most cancer is cookie cutter, recipe driven, NCCN guideline or payer guideline driven. And oncologists make decisions about cancer when they don't have the precision medicine information, they don't have the genomics information, maybe they don't have all the pathology, they don't know the radiology, and they just go, okay, here you go. You're getting major myosin, and this is what we're doing. And that's not good medicine at the end of the day. So this is where I think we should be going and striving towards, but yeah, everybody sort of has to get on the page, like, this is going to help. It's not going to hinder what you're doing.
Great, appreciate that. All right, as we come to here closing and have some time for questions, I just want to kind of summarize the success here. Obviously, taking what Andy and Dr. Sorensen have provided to us, as well as other organizations we work with, I want to emphasize what U.S. Health Tech sees as the key thing, which is the foundation must be there, like building a house. If you don't have a good foundation, you really can't build up from that. So having a trusted partner that can help you build, lay down that foundation, have that forethought and the design plans to help build that out is key. Being able to have that integration and data flow defined and put in place, experience and automation, and then of course, again, partnering with people that you trust and who know what they're doing. So once again, I'd like to thank Andy from Page AI and Dr. Sorensen from DeepHealth with US Health Tech. Appreciate their time and all of yours. We'll be happy to take some questions now. We have some time. But otherwise, I think we have Strand 1 room for the duration of the event. If anyone ever wants to come down and say hi and ask any additional questions. So thank you. Where's the first question? Yes, sir.
Success. This is almost like a catch-22. The more successful it is, the less people you'll need to do the work that AI is doing.
Yeah. Could you all hear that question in the back?
Quickly reiterate it. Yeah. I mean, the issue here is if you make the physician 20% more efficient, payers are going to say, great, I can pay them
20% less. Yeah.
And now I'm working 20% harder for nothing, right? So there's definitely a sort of a concern about that. Yeah. And the flip side is there, too. If you bring them AI and it doesn't make them more efficient, but it's more work to do, then they're going to say, well, I'm not going to do that unless you pay me more. And so now AI is costing the system money for what end, right? So there is a little bit of a, there's no question there's a challenge here. I think what most of the physicians feel like is, that I've talked with, is there's a lag. And so if you are the early adopter and you get that efficiency win, and then it's 5 years before the RUC does its work to do the surveys and say, okay, now we're gonna cut reimbursement, you've got that benefit before that reimbursement cut happens. And then when that by then you've moved on to the next efficiency win. And so it does feel a little bit like the story of, I don't need to outrun the bear, I just need to outrun you, kind of thing. But the reality of our payment system is that's kind of, you're right. The physicians realize that if they are more efficient, they're paid kind of by the amount of work they do, and the way CMS sets it up is a fixed pie. But that doesn't mean that if you do more, you still don't get paid more. So I think the incentives mostly align. Yeah. I do think people, the one thing that does expand, sadly for some of us, is the payer's contribution increasingly is the employer.
Right.
And that isn't fixed. Yeah. So employers are willing to pay more for benefits. And in fact, the reason Blue Cross decided to pay for this $40 copay was because it was one of the ERISA groups said, we want this for all of our employees.
Yeah.
We
yeah.
see how beneficial it is, so yeah. we will pay. And why? Because we're going to get, we have a 5-year horizon.
Yeah.
We're willing to see that this is going to save us money because our employees aren't with us for 18 months. Our employees are with us for 20 years.
That's right.
So we would just as soon get the, and it is actually economically beneficial for them to have their employees not sick.
Yeah.
So I think there are solutions to this conundrum, but you're right that there are pockets of inefficiency and we're going to have to, there are definitely bumps that we're going to have to navigate.
Yeah. Agreed. I think there's one other thing to think about, too, from the payer perspective. I think we're seeing innovative, so like self-insured employers, especially
exactly.
the big ones, Walmarts, Amazon, right? You know, thinking through how AI can be a beneficiary to your employers, to your employees. So again, you want to do two things as a self-insured, but you want to, A, keep your costs down because you're paying for it. And so if you can find cancers earlier and get those patients treated early, it seems like a win. So I think we're already starting to see that a little bit in radiology. There's some interesting models happening where you're getting some screening done from some of these big employers. So I don't think it always has to be from that pool of money. Again, to Dr. Sorensen's business model too, patients are paying for it. Right, you know, because at the end of the day, it's, and we're starting to see this, right? Consumer health, everyone, especially younger generations and Zs and millennials, like they want to know all their health records. They all want it in one app. They want to know exactly what's going on. If you're willing to pay $50 to $100 for an AI read, I think we should start to at least figure out if there's a there, because ultimately, to your point, the pool of money for payers is only so much, right? They're only going to decrease it.
Next question. In the back.
Hi, this question is for Dr. Sorensen. So regarding mammograms, are there any cases where an MRI would be warranted to confirm the AI result?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, normally the way the screening process works is on the time of screening, all you get is come back next year because there's nothing here, or come in for more pictures. And those more pictures can be more x-rays, it can be an ultrasound, or in some cases an MRI. And that really depends on what it looks like once you start to do more work. And yes, in the end, about 3% or 4% of women who get mammograms end up getting an MRI, most of them before or as part of a biopsy. So, but it's a much smaller number, and while there is AI for MRI, it's just not the same impact because it's not a screening tool. So we recently opened a screening location in Walmart, actually. So after you go through the checkout counter, you could get, you know, your nails done, or you can go to the bank, or now there's a mammogram now place. And that's actually quite popular with some people because, like, they're there. So there's not going to be an MRI there. There's not going to be even a diagnostic workup. But screening mammograms is pretty easy to get. And we only felt comfortable doing that because of AI. We felt like, okay, now we can get quality out there. And AI will also help with things like the quality of the acquisition. You know, we haven't really talked about that yet. It's really been more about how the physician sees things. But there is value to saying, is this image appropriate? Was it stained right? Or was the x-ray positioned right? Yep. And if not, redo it right now, kind of thing. So I think there's actually a fair amount of AI in the interstices. That's already kind of happening. Just like they say in ChatGPT, a lot of it's happening in the enterprise. Yeah. That's also, there's a lot of things that are happening already that aren't taking anybody's jobs. They're just sort of helping things. And even directing, should you get this kind of test or that kind of test. So those things are happening, I think, in the background. And the impact is easier to see in things like mammography because it's so widespread. But I think it's going to get through much of medicine if we can figure out how to do it in a sustainable way. That's the challenge. Is we both started with venture backing. You know, like the venture guys are like, hey, this looks cool. Yeah. But eventually, it has to come into something sustainable.
Right.
And if we don't figure out a way, then it will disappear. And sometimes that's good because it wasn't a good idea. But if it's a good idea, you'd like to find some path to sustainability. And that's I think that's the journey we're on.
Yeah.
Who is next? Back now, right here. Let's start right here, Tyler.
For individuals that have genetic disorders such as BRCA2 with mammograms, right now the direction of BRCA2 is just go straight to the MRI, completely avoid the mammogram because of the increased risk and the complexity. Do you think AI is going to get to a point where there's more confidence in it, and it's like you don't need the MRI straight away, we can do a mammogram because we're more confident in it with the algorithms?
Yeah, you know, the genetic and a family history predispositions for people to go on down a different care pathway, in this case, a different kind of screening paradigm rather than annual x-ray mammograms, an annual MRI, or every other year MRI. For sure, I think AI will increasingly help extract the information out. I'm really interested in doing a project with one of the genetics firms. Could we use AI on the mammogram to predict who should get a BRCA test to figure out, because BRCA is, I think, around 0.3% of the population, so it's not frequent enough at a $2,000 a pop or $1,000 a pop test, unlike a mammogram that's more like $200, to offer to everybody. So you really want to just, if you can figure out who needs it with a questionnaire or perhaps with an AI algorithm, then I don't know whether we ever get to a place where the AI on a mammogram is good enough to obviate BRCA, not need that test. However, I do think that we could get to a place where AI looking at an x-ray mammogram would say, I've got a better, I'm doing a better job of figuring out who needs a different screening paradigm.
Yeah.
Because BRCA isn't a guaranteed bad outcome, right? It's just a super high risk marker. And I think we will find, with enough data, we'll find signatures, whether it's on a pathology slide or on a mammogram or a chest x-ray, that say, if for some disease you're super high risk and you should, you know, pass go, do not collect $200, go straight to, you know, this thing. So I think you're right. That's part of the promise, that we'll get better precision medicine and more tailored care for people. I think that's the vision. I don't know of anything that's doing that quite yet.
Yeah, I mean, there's some in pathology. I mean, even for us, you know, like microsatellite instability for colon cancer patients. It's NCCN guidelines. If you have colon, you should get an MSI. You should be mismatch repaired or whatever. And it was a study a couple years ago, only about 66% of patients were actually getting MSI tested. And so, you know, one of the values of AI is that you're already doing the mammogram, you're already making an H&E slide. The only destructive anything to that tissue is there is none. You're just using the image and then the AI and then the compute. And the information that you get out of that is unbelievable, right? Yeah, so you get that. So you can, we have a test out for MSI. We can detect it with 96% sensitivity.
Off the H&E,
right? And so you don't have to do an extra test. And ultimately, the costs for that are dollars, not hundreds of dollars, right? And so there is a hugely amazing cost effectiveness here, because you're already doing the mammogram. You can get the information from the mammogram, determine the path of care. Same on an H&E slide. You're already making an H&E slide. You can get all the information about that patient, not need really expensive downstream tests. And I think going back to the payer issue, I think we'll see in socialized countries where there was single payer, this is where this is going to come out.
Yeah.
This, you're going to find those kind of applications of AI get paid for, because they're going to say, I don't want to pay $1,000 for a genomic screening test when with 99% sensitivity, I can do an H&E AI test for $50.
Yeah.
Right? And I think ultimately you'll find the patient outcomes will be just as good, if not better. And that's how those things are going to get paid. And so there's going to be this give and take on it. But it's interesting. You can start what you see on an image, whether it's an H&E or it's a mammogram, all those kind of things. AI is just really much better at human beings at discerning those patterns that associate with outcomes or genetics or those kind of things than we are.
Great. Any other questions right here?
I was curious if you had a information of the future. In the relationship between AI application and high-throughput molecular diagnostics, such as next-gen sequencing, high-throughput infectious disease panels, and if AI could have an impact in efficiency and cost-effectiveness, or if it will be negligible.
Yeah, I think it already is. I mean, I think you see most of the major molecular test providers starting to, you know, obviously genomics, you're getting tons of data, right? At the end of the day, lots of data is a great place to start with AI. Let's find the patterns that are associated with that. You know, there are plenty of tests out there on molecular tests for like cancer of unknown primary, for example, so where you can look at thousands and thousands of genomes or whatever your test or DNA-seq or whatever, and then determine, okay, I know what the patterns look like to determine if there's a cancer or not primary, what the highest probability of those kind of things are, right? So I think ultimately AI is not just imaging-based, it's language-based, it's data-based. You can make those associations. Essentially, at the end of the day, AI is just really complex pattern matching. That's all it is. And so anytime you have tons of data to work through, I think genomics is going to be one of those areas that certainly is going to come as part of that. I do think we're going to see this age of multimodal AI. So it's the molecular plus the radiology plus the pathology plus the EMR and the clinical information that'll help create some sort of prediction for that patient. That's when you get into really cool Star Trek-y stuff, where it's like, let's bring all this stuff together. That one model brings it all together and provides the best course of treatment. That's coming. It's the technology is available. It's just obviously not in real world everyday use.
Next question. Anybody? Again.
One of the things I think that's on a collision, by the way, thank you very much. It's great. I totally agree with all this stuff. I'm very excited about it. One of the collisions I see happening is with ECMO. A lot of bring this care to the most people.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's a ways away from it. Like right now, there's just not enough in the pot to cover the needs of people who can't access.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, look, We're, like I said, we're super into access. Like I said, we've opened 3 Walmart locations precisely to try to get more access for people. But we've also gotten a fair amount of pushback from my academic colleagues who say, you're charging $40. That's going to exclude some people. Our data suggests actually it's not so much that, because we have really high enrollment in Queens and in areas that are quite low socioeconomic status. The thing that it seems to most correlate with is they're concerned that they might have cancer, kind of their own family history. Those are the people who are the most likely to enroll. But you're right. There's no question that it's if we didn't have to charge the $40, we wouldn't. And that AI is coming to the haves before it's coming to the have-nots. Yeah. And I don't know how to solve some of these big inequity problems we see in our society, but I do actually think what I said earlier. I think AI is actually powerful and going to help. We can, you know, one of my first application or first people I talked to was a radiologist who worked on a military base, and they were providing military care or care for military members overseas. They see a tiny number per year, and so their quality can't be as good. Yeah. Because they just don't have the volume. And we all know in medicine, like everything, the more volume, the better you get at it. Bringing an AI tool to somebody like that, that pathologist is going to get, you know, a better read, or the radiologist is going to get a better read. And I think that is, whether it's an Indian reservation or, rural care, I do think AI is not getting the credit it deserves, candidly, for how it could help reduce some of those inequalities. Now, FDA is pretty nervous, like we all are, that we don't miss out on certain subpopulations. We happened, for that study I showed you, to recruit on some neighborhoods on the East Coast, and it turned out at random that 52% of the women in that study were black, and the FDA said, well, that's too many black women. You need to, you know, readjust down for the right, you know, proportional number, because they're statisticians and they want to see. But, you know, it's we were fortunate that it actually performed very well in black women. But you should ask, does it perform well in black patients? Does it perform well in Hispanic patients? And do you have data that, have you tested this? Because none of us want a stop sign or a self-driving car that always misses stop signs that have one letter missing, right? I mean, you anything systematic, it bothers us. So if whenever the painted lines were yellow instead of white, the self-driving car stopped working, we would all be mad at that. Yeah. And it's the systematic thing that we're all trying to avoid. So the things we can identify, like racial bias or age bias or breast density bias or staining or whatever, those should be tested for. And we are trying to stamp those out. Yep. Are there other biases we haven't even thought of yet? Yep. For sure. And when we identify those, then we'll fix those too. What I think goes unsaid is all of us doctors have that same biases.
Yeah, yeah.
Like we were all trained on white textbooks of dermatology examples, and like nobody seemed to be mad at then. Yeah. Like why are we so, well, the reason we're mad now is because of that systematic thing, and we'd like to think we humans can compensate for it, which I think is delusional. It's much better to say let's make it more equal by bringing these digital tools where we know that they behave well on all groups.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question. Anyone? No?
Nope.
Thank you. This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.